Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for the Education Report and the Making of a Nation, coming up after As It Is.
Hello and welcome back. It's time to improve your American English skills with VOA. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. Today we have two stories for you. First, we will talk about Myanmar, the country also known as Burma. We will look back at the many changes the country has experienced recently. Then it's time to relax with a cup of coffee. We'll have some new information about one of the world's most popular drinks. Now, on to part one. Many changes have taken place in Myanmar over the past few years. The government has eased restrictions on the media and released political prisoners. Foreign investment has risen in Myanmar, also known as Burma, but there have been few changes in the country's armed forces. Myanmar is now preparing for elections in 2015. Bob Doty reports on the reforms that critics say have become endangered.
Myanmar's economy has experienced major changes in recent years. Government controls on the economy have been reduced. The country has a new banking system and new land policies. In addition, the value of the nation's money is now decided by the market, not the government. These steps and others have helped bring an estimated $9 billion in foreign investment to Myanmar since 2011. Economist Sean Turnell says the many changes have made the economy more functional to improve operation. But he says they have done little to change the military's influence in both the economy and in politics.
In our movement towards some new government form after 2015, that issue of the military and its role, will it be the central actor? Will it give up some of that economic control? Will it step back in any way, in a meaningful way that really needs to happen? Well, that's really the big question.
In Myanmar, the military still controls the country's largest businesses. It also controls most of the country's most profitable industries, such as natural gas exploration and gemstone mining. The military has almost as much economic influence as it does political power. 25% of all seats in parliament are set aside for military appointees. That gives the armed forces veto power over all constitutional changes. This has meant little accountability or willingness to accept responsibility when military forces are accused of rights abuses. Last month, Harvard Law School's International Human Rights Clinic released a report on Myanmar. The report accused four military officials of war crimes and crimes against humanity in 2005 and 2006. The four include current Home Affairs Minister Major General Coco. Matthew Buer is Harvard's Global Justice Fellow in Yangon, Myanmar's largest city. He says there is enough evidence to order the arrest of the four officials, but no charges. He says, until top military officials are held responsible in a civilian-controlled justice system, the military will continue to act without fear of punishment.
The military has set their foot down and said that they aren't willing to address their conduct, and they're threatening people who do try to address that. We think that reformers in the government and opposition politicians who may want to deal with these issues haven't taken a strong enough stand to address human rights abuses and address military conduct. We also think that the military is promoting rights abusers up the chain of command and into primary positions.
Myanmar's political opposition has gained seats in parliament, but the opposition has been unable to end the military's influence. Critics have wanted opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi to speak out. Critics say the Nobel Peace Prize winner has failed to push for accountability. Some say she has avoided disputes with the military in the hopes it will improve her chances as a possible candidate for president. Myanmar's generals are defending their continuing influence in the country. They point to the rebellion by ethnic fighters in some parts of the country. Myanmar spends 23.2% of its national budget on the military, the highest percentage in Southeast Asia. The military says the money is used in part to fight groups that reject the government. But outside observers say the military's business interests are partly to blame for the rebellions. Harvard's Matthew Buer says the military's economic interests in conflict areas is partly to blame. He says those interests are stretching out the peace process and reducing trust in the government and military. Last month, government troops shelled a training ground for ethnic minority troops, killing 27 soldiers. The attack came just one day after peace talks had ended. The government of President Thein Sein wants to get a ceasefire in place throughout the nation before the elections late next year. A change in Myanmar's constitution would be needed to reduce the military's influence in government. Last month, military representatives made clear their unwillingness to amend the constitution before 2015. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to VOA, and we are coming to you from Washington. An international team of researchers has created a sequence or map of the genes of the coffee plant known as Robusta. About one-third of the coffee drunk worldwide comes from this plant. Christopher Cruz tells us more about the new map of what the researchers call the irresistible bean that delivers the most widely consumed psychoactive drug in the world.
Researchers hope to use the map they created to make changes to the plant's genes. The researchers were surprised to discover the genes for caffeine. They discovered coffee's caffeine genes are not linked to the caffeine genes in the cacao tree. Cacao beans are used to make chocolate. With the new gene map, researchers say they may be able to develop plants that can survive climate change. They may also be able to create a coffee plant that does not have caffeine. The researchers say that would let growers and coffee makers produce coffee that tastes better than the kind that has the caffeine removed. We drink 2.5 billion cups of coffee every day. Coffee is the main agricultural crop in many tropical countries. The genetic map of the coffee plant Robusta was published in the journal Science. The researchers say the plant joins a long list of crop species that have been sequenced using ever-improving computer programs. I'm Christopher Cruz.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to The Voice of America.
The Education Report is next, followed by The Making of a Nation. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
This is the VOA Learning English Education Report. Education is a growing issue of dispute in Turkey between those who support religion in government and those who oppose it. Opponents are criticizing Turkey's National Education Council for its proposal to require religious classes in schools. The two sides also dispute a council-supported plan to begin what it calls values education for the youngest students. In addition, the main opposition group in Turkey, the Republican People's Party, has objected to a proposal to teach the Ottoman language in schools. Turks no longer speak the language. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan rejects the criticism. He says people will learn and teach the language. The National Education Council advises Turkey's Ministry of Education. The council called for required religious classes in high schools to be changed from 1 to 2 hours weekly and extended to all ages. Chinggis Aktar writes about politics for the newspaper Zaman Today and teaches at Süleyman Şah University. He says the reforms fit well with President Erdogan's goals.
For years, Mr. Erdogan is announcing that he wants to create a new pious youth, ethically correct and according to the canons of his mind and his lecture of Islam, and he is just putting this into practice.
Religious schools in Turkey are known as Imam Hatips. The number of these schools sharply increased during Mr. Erdogan's leadership as prime minister. In 2004, 65,000 children attended them. Now that number is more than 1 million. The schools provide 13 hours weekly of religious training. Boys and girls are separated in the schools. In recent years, many non-religious schools have become Imam Hatips. A mother said, many times parents receive no warning of such change. The changes have led to protests in Istanbul. Mr. Erdogan argues that religious education offers an answer for social problems children face, including illegal drugs and racism. Turkey's Religious Affairs Directorate governs Islam in the country. A top official with the agency says that the policy of a religiously neutral government is weakening religious life in Turkish society. Ishtar Gozadin is an expert on religion and the state at Doğuş University in Istanbul. She says the government is changing Turkish society.
The presidency of religious affairs being more active in, for example, hospitals, women's shelters. So apparently there is a more conservative society is being tried to be constructed. However, there isn't much respect for the freedom from religion.
And that's the VOA Learning English Education Report. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. America's Civil War in the 1860s did not have the full support of the people. Many said they did not care who won. north or south. They just wanted to be left alone. In the north, many young men refused to be drafted into the Union Army. Some of their protests turned violent. Southern leaders were pleased with the anti-war movement in the North. Confederate General Robert E. Lee saw it as a sign of weakness in the Northern war effort. He also saw it as an opening for a military victory. Lee hoped for a final, decisive blow that would bring the war to an end. This week in our series, Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe talk about General Lee's campaign north to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania.
Gettysburg was a small town. Many roads came together there. Robert E. Lee needed those roads to pull his army together quickly. He had 70,000 men in all, but they were spread over a wide area of southern Pennsylvania. Some were at York to the east. Some were at Carlisle to the north, and most were at Chambersburg to the west. All of them were ordered to move against the Union force at Gettysburg. General Robert E. Lee had not planned to go to Gettysburg. He had planned to capture Harrisburg, the state capital, and then Philadelphia. If successful, he would turn south to seize Baltimore and Washington. Lee had not worried about the large Union Army of the Potomac. He believed it was far behind him in Virginia. But Lee was wrong. The Union Army had followed him, and it had reached Gettysburg first.
The first group of Northern soldiers formed a thin line of defense outside Gettysburg. The first group of Southern soldiers attacked this line. It was the morning of July 1st, 1863. When the guns began to roar, both sides hurried more men to the front. After hours of fighting, the Confederates had pushed the Union soldiers back through the town. The Union soldiers formed a new line along a place called Cemetery Hill. General Robert E. Lee decided not to attack the hill immediately. He would wait for more men. But as he waited, more and more Union soldiers arrived. By sunrise the next day, Lee's 70,000 men faced a Union army of 90,000 men.
The Confederates attacked both sides of the Union line. They moved the Union soldiers a little, but then the Union soldiers came back again. The Confederates could not hold the line. The fighting stopped at sunset. Union Commander George Meade met with his generals. He said he was sure General Lee would attack again the next day. The next attack, Meade said, would be against the center of the Union line. Meade was right. Lee planned to send 15,000 men against the Union center. They would be under the command of General George Pickett.
When the sun rose on July 3rd, the Union troops were ready. They watched as the Confederate troops set up their cannon. More than 130 of these big guns were aimed at the center of the Union line. The morning passed. The day grew hotter. A little past 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a Confederate gun fired once, then again. That was the signal to attack. All at once, the Confederate artillery thundered with a deafening roar. The cannon sent iron and smoke into the Union soldiers on Cemetery Hill. Within minutes, hundreds lay dead or dying. Union artillery on the hill answered the Confederate cannon. Men lay flat on the ground. They prayed for the shelling to stop. Finally, it did, and the smoke of battle began to clear.
Now the Union soldiers could see across the valley. They watched as the Confederate soldiers formed a long line. It was a sight to take your breath away. Facing Cemetery Hill, the Confederates stood shoulder to shoulder in a line almost 2 kilometers long. Sunlight shone from their guns. Their battle flags waved. Slowly, the line began to move. It seemed more like a parade than an attack. Shouts went up and down the Union line. Here they come. Here come the rebels.
Thousands of Confederate soldiers moved across the valley outside Gettysburg. Union artillery opened fire. The guns tore open big holes in the Confederate battle line. But the Southerners kept moving forward up the hill. Union soldiers rose up from behind stone walls and fallen trees. They poured even more gunfire into the Confederate line. More and more bodies fell to the ground. Still, the line moved forward. A few Confederates reached the Union line, but not enough to seize it. They were shot down. Suddenly, the Confederates began racing down the hill. Many raised their hands in surrender. 15,000 began the attack. Only half returned. The Battle of Gettysburg was over. The Union commander, General Meade, was told that the Confederate attack had been broken. He said simply, "Thank God." The Confederate commander, General Lee, said, "This has been a sad day for us. A sad day."
Lee's invasion of the North had failed. There was only one thing he could do now, retreat. He must get his army back to Virginia. He could only hope that the Union army was hurt too badly to chase him. The line of wagons carrying wounded soldiers was 25 kilometers long. Many of the wounded needed treatment, but the wagons were not permitted to stop for any reason. Suffering was terrible. An officer who led the wagon train said he learned more about the horrors of war on that one trip than he had learned in all of his battles. 20,000 Confederate soldiers were killed, wounded, or listed as missing in the Battle of Gettysburg. 23,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing.
General Meade lost so many men that he was in no hurry to chase General Lee. He believed it might be best to let Lee escape than to take a chance on losing what remained of the Army of the Potomac. Meade waited for a week until his army was stronger. But by then, Lee and his men had crossed safely back into Virginia. President Abraham Lincoln was angry. He had told General Meade that driving the Confederates out of the North was not enough. The Southern Army must be destroyed. "We had them," Lincoln said. "We had only to stretch out our hands and take them. And nothing I could do or say could make the army move."
President Lincoln believed that General Meade had made a mistake, but he felt that the general had ability. Lincoln was thankful for what Meade had done at Gettysburg. He said Meade would continue to command the Army of the Potomac. In November of 1863, President Lincoln went to Gettysburg. He attended the opening of a new burial place for the Union soldiers who had died in the great battle there.
The governor of Pennsylvania had asked the president to say a few words at the ceremony. Lincoln agreed. He felt it was his duty to go, to honor the brave men who lost their lives to save the Union. Lincoln hoped his words might help lift the spirit of the nation. Lincoln did not have much time to prepare his speech. He wrote it down the night before the ceremony. Lincoln was sure the speech was not a good one, but it came to be one of the most famous speeches in American history. We will tell the story of Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address next week.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe. Transcripts, MP3s, and podcasts of our programs are online, along with historical images, at voaspecialenglish.com. And you can follow our weekly programs on Twitter, at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.